Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in European Studies, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I'm Tim Jones, and I'm joined today by Gabor Schering, author of The Retreat of Liberal Democracy, Authoritarian Capitalism and the Accumulative State in Hungary, published in 2020 by Palgrave Macmillan. As 4 years of Donald Trump's presidency draws to a close, his opponents have given thanks that he was too lazy and incompetent to use the powers and agencies at his disposal. If he had, he could have used two terms to create an illiberal democracy, a country that maintains democratic trappings, but with a charismatic leader in charge of a hegemonic party, politicized permanent institutions, and a structurally split opposition struggling to counter a nationalist narrative coming from the top. What he should have done was follow the career of Viktor Orban, Hungary's prime minister for the past decade, and the man who coined the term illiberal democracy in 2014. Over the last 12 months, a number of books have been published in English attempting to explain Orbán's hybrid model of democracy and authoritarianism, including The Orbán Regime by András Kurecseni and Orbánland by Lesa Skut. I will be interviewing these authors in the coming months, but today Dr. Schering will kick off our exploration of Orbanism with his economic and political study of what he calls the accumulative state. Gabor is an economist and sociologist who is currently a Marie Curie Fellow at Bocconi University in Milan and was a Green member of the Hungarian Parliament from 2010 to 2014. Gabor, welcome to the podcast.
Hello, and thank you very much for inviting me. This is a great opportunity to discuss both the book and the state of democracy in Hungary and probably also beyond.
Yeah, well, thank you for joining. At the core of your book is this concept that you borrow from Alan Wolfe's Limits of Legitimacy, the idea of an accumulative state and how it develops as a compromise between established and emerging classes. Can you explain the idea and how it applies to Hungary's 30-plus year transition from socialism?
Yeah, so indeed this is perhaps the central conceptual innovation in the book. So to step back, there are a lot of narratives out there about populism, illiberalism, both in Hungary and Europe, but you mentioned Trump in the introduction, that look at various dimensions. Mostly you will read about politicians themselves. So when it comes to Hungary, there are great articles and, in fact, books about Orbán himself. Hmm. And, of course, it's crucial to understand his character and what he's doing. But, you know, politicians are never operating in a social vacuum. And then the other thing that you very often encounter is articles about culture, like people's so-called demand for anti-liberal or illiberal politics. And there's an element of truth to this also. Like in my book myself, I look at the culture of nationalism. But the problem itself in this is that, as I show in the book, people did not want to destroy democracy. In fact, they supported liberal values, liberal institutions more than in most other countries in Central and Eastern Europe. So culture itself, people's attitudes itself, does not explain what has happened to Hungary. You don't really read that much about economic elites and their role and about the dislocation of the working class. And these are the two key processes that I am analyzing in the book. When you read about the economic elites, then sometimes you can read some misleading arguments out there saying that basically, except for a small group of friends and members of Viktor Orban's family, so often called the cronies, everyone else is losing out. Mm-hmm. Right? So that's what you most often read in the news about corruption, grand corruption in Hungary, which is part of the system. But here comes the idea of the accumulative state, which in a sense is meant to capture, as you very well put it, the compromise between the three most important factions of the power coalition. So this is nationalist politicians, Fidesz and Viktor Orban, the rising group of domestic capitalists, which includes cronies, but goes much beyond them. So it's a larger group of domestic businesses, and also transnational corporations, most importantly German manufacturing companies, but not just German manufacturing companies, foreign investors, especially in export, technologically intensive export sectors, are the third most important pillars of this regime. And what Viktor Orban did basically was emancipating domestic capitalists from their previous position, which was very much a subordinate compared to transnational capital before 2010. And that's his most important achievement. He did not reduce Hungary's dependence altogether on foreign investment, but makes more room for domestic capitalists. And for this, he receives their support, as I've said, a very large, overwhelming majority of the domestic business elite supports him, in addition to most of the foreign investors. So what the accumulative state does is it introduces various policies and institutional structures designed to accelerate capital accumulation or the creation of wealth, supporting both all three segments of the elite. So the politicians, obviously, they generate their own wealth. Domestic businesses, domestic capitalists are generating immense wealth these days in Hungary. And foreign businesses are enjoying a very favorable institutional environment. Hungary has the lowest corporate tax rate in Europe. Overall, very lax labor regulation, unemployment benefit that lasts only 3 months, etc., etc., austerity. So all the what you might call neoliberal policies, most of them are still there on the lower bound, preferred by foreign businesses especially. So this is what the cumulative state does. And as you might imagine, this creates a lot of tensions socially. Hungary is now the most unequal country in Central and Eastern Europe, a region which was usually heralded as a region with low inequality because of welfare policy interventions into the economy. But this is not so much true for Hungary anymore, which is now more unequal than the Czech Republic or Slovakia. So inequality has been rapidly increasing under Viktor Orban. And this is a very conscious and deliberate policy effort from the side of the government to redistribute money upwards. And my argument in the book is that this regime would not be sustainable politically under normal liberal democratic circumstances. So what Viktor Orban does is two things. First, he restructured the institutional landscape to make the regime more sustainable, conquering the media, conquering independent institutions. So this is what I call in the book institutional authoritarianism. And he also introduces policies and engages in a kind of politics which is more about discourses and creating an appearance of fighting for the people. But this is basically, in a sense, duping especially lower middle classes and working classes because they are losing out under Orbán. So you might call this populism or authoritarian populism, where, you know, it's about Viktor Orbán fighting migrants trying to legitimize his regime by presenting himself as the grand protector of the nation. So these two sides of authoritarianism, the soft side and the institutional hard side, I think are there to serve this very unequal and polarizing political economic regime that I term the accumulative state in the book. And it's a kind of authoritarian capitalism, which is a more broader term. You know, you can observe authoritarian varieties of capitalism all around the world, China being the most famous example, and Hungary is one version of this kind of authoritarian capitalism.
Yeah, it's a very interesting take, because we all read about how he was part of the resistance generation and then turned authoritarian over time, but in your book you talk about it much more fundamentally than that. That his first government, He continued this economic policy of favoring transnational capital. And it was only after he went back into opposition that you say, I'll find the quote, you say, Fidesz's efforts at building an economic hinterland were premeditated, systematic, and aggressive. And so he made this pitch to national capital. And you have this very interesting chapter where you talk about how billionaires essentially had been left-leaning in the first decade of capitalism. And then once he came into power the second time from 2010 onwards, you saw this very sudden move in political allegiance among the billionaire class. So yes, could you expand on those thoughts?
Yeah. So left-leaning in Hungary and in my book mostly is a category referring to political positions, not necessarily ideological or policy content. So left-leaning means basically closer in terms of networks to the Socialist Party and the smaller Liberal Party in Hungary, the Socialist Party being the successor of the State Socialist Party. But in effect, they presided over some of the most avant-garde neoliberal policies, like the privatization of pensions, an attempted but then ultimately failed attempt to privatize health insurance, and also in general favoring privatization methods that favor foreign investment as opposed to domestic capitalists. And domestic capitalists have nevertheless been able to secure some foothold through privatization some of them just generally accumulating wealth on the market. And they have been also lobbying the left-wing government, so the Socialist Party and the smaller Liberal Party, to change its attitude and introduce, traditional developmental state policies or industrial policies that are meant to protect domestic capitalists against foreign competition and to generate local value chains. But the left-leaning elite or the Socialist Liberal Coalition was not really willing to do this. So they were very much governing in coalition with foreign investment and with a group of technocrats. Part of those people are politicians, part of those are economists who were very, very influential. So this was the previous power elite before 2010, technocrats, foreign investors, and mostly the left liberal elite. But Fidesz also was part of this power structure. When they were first in government, they accepted the terms of the game. But as you say, and I show in the book that in the 2000s, Orbán sensed that there is a growing frustration among domestic capitalists. And whereas in the 90s, these domestic capitalists, some of them were able to gain wealth through privatization, and it was mostly managers coming from the socialist times. That's why some of them, or the majority of the economic elite in the 90s, was more kind of affiliated to the socialist party. So it was clearly the socialist leaning billionaires, not in terms of policy, but in terms of sheer party politics, that were dominant in the 90s. But nevertheless, there was a growing frustration among them that there is like too many policies favoring transnational corporations, and basically domestic companies cannot do anything. That was their perception. And it was Fidesz and Viktor Orbán who sensed that there's an opportunity, and they basically said, okay, enough of this ideological opposition to so-called former socialist managers, and let's embrace the economic elite as it is, and start to offer them a new kind of economic nationalist policies to help them accelerate their capital, in return for them supporting me and supporting my party. And in my book, I show that there's various groups to the economic elite, to the domestic business class. There's a group that is very closely allied with Fidesz. These are the people whom you can mostly read about in the news, you know, involved in grand corruption. And these people very often serve direct political purposes. So they would buy up media outlets and run basically finance political campaigns. But there are other groups as well, like ideologically committed conservatives who have also been traditional playing an important role in establishing right-wing media. And they are not, you know, they are not cronies. They are not corrupt in a sense as the first group is. And there is a group of emerging capitalists. Numerically, this is the biggest among the right-leaning billionaires in Hungary. And they are the kind of people who were lobbying both left and right-wing governments to protect them against transnational corporations. And it was Fidesz who in fact promised this in 2000s in opposition, and then started to deliver on its promise once in power in the 2010s. So this is why I think the most important achievement of Viktor Orbán is that he kind of emancipated domestic capitalists, so renegotiated the terms of the deal that the political elite made with transnational corporations in the 90s, where to simplify, it was all about transnational capital. And Fidesz said, okay, you can keep your dominant positions in the industry, especially technological intensive industry and industries that are crucial for exports, but we will make room for domestic capitalists in other areas like retail, banking, media, etc. So it's a new deal for so to speak, a new deal for domestic capitalists, and the most important tools and policies designed to accelerate capital accumulation are policies that, you know, hurt lower middle classes, working classes, and precarious strata of society.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like
filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, and the impact, as you point out in the book, is not just the impact of the split between transnational capital and national capital. Is a split in the working class as well. So again, I have a quote here. You say it causes social polarization between skilled workers working for foreign companies in large towns and low-skilled laborers working for domestic enterprises in small towns. And you to back this up, you carried out more than 80 interviews with workers in four Rust Belt towns. These were all people who'd been adults at the time of transition, so they were able to compare the two. And what's very striking is how nostalgic people are for the past. And you have this you sort of narrow that down as being the result of lost non-material benefits, you know, things like guaranteed holidays, holiday homes, and full employment, obviously. Do you think? And what's also interesting there is that these people seem to be embedded in their thought that it's the old Socialist Party, the MSZP, that is almost personally responsible for the negative aspects of this change, whereas Fidesz is not.
Yeah. Yes, indeed. So, the empirical part of the book, as you say, has basically two sides. One is a new database, both quantitative and qualitative, on the economic elites. So I show how it changes numerically the composition, and also I show the discourses and the, you know, the lobby efforts of business groups. And the other side of the story is basically how Orban constructs his electoral majority. And there, I think, workers left behind in these medium-sized industrialized towns play a crucial role. They are not the only ones who are supporting Orban, but they are important to understand change and dynamics. You know, it's like the same with Trump. These kind of workers left behind in the industrialized towns are not the most important supporters in terms of, like, you know, average income of Republican voters is still higher than the Democrats. But what was crucial for Trump's success in 2016 was his ability to attract disillusioned workers in a large number who shifted allegiance from Democrats to the Republicans. And you can see you could observe the same in Hungary. So whereas in the 90s and early 2000s, so basically 2002, the Socialist Party was overrepresented among workers, and these small and medium-sized industrialized towns acted as the regional strongholds of the Socialist Party until the early 2000s. This has changed dramatically in the 2000s. It has already started to change before the financial crisis. So it's not only about the financial crisis, but more about the exhaustion of this market economy model or capitalist model that Hungary has been following after state socialism. And as you say, a lot of workers are nostalgic, but this is not, you know, just you know, it's not just older people, let's say, who are nostalgic, but also younger people who you know, had some experience, but they are still sort of capable to work and theoretically should have been capable to make a decent living under under the new capitalist regime, but we're not. In fact, there's a generational gap, because housing was one of the most important services provided by the socialist state, and of course access was unequal, and the state was not able to produce enough houses, but still housing was secure for most people. Families could, you know, apply for houses basically, and they got it either for free or they got subsidized loans from companies. So if you grew up under socialism, you had no problem living somewhere. Now this dramatically changed with the transition, where social housing was completely prioritized, and it was suddenly the responsibility of people to secure houses, which led to massive indebtedness. And whereas other generations had their homes, the newer generations had to amass massive debts, and a very large segment of the population by the second half of the 2000s was, because of this indebtedness, unable to face unexpected financial expenses. So that's one crucial part of why people grew disillusioned. Another is, if you look at employment in Hungary, has been chronically low until basically 2012. So basically the employment collapsed after state socialism and remained low until the end of the 2000s. The employment rate was the lowest in Europe, and one of the lowest in the whole OECD region in Hungary. So economists call this jobless growth. And I also refer to my other research area, which is the political economy of health. And this aspect I find is very powerful to capture the lived experience of economic change. And in the 90s, there was what public health people call the post-socialist mortality crisis hitting Hungary, leading to several tens of thousands of excess deaths in the 90s, which mostly hit middle-aged working-class people, especially working-class men. And as you can imagine, this was the most severe, again, in small and medium-sized deindustrialized towns. So this created these areas that were previously leaning left because these were towns that grew under state socialism, but then collapsed during the 90s. People still had some belief in the Socialist Party until basically 2002, when the party was flirting with social democratic ideas. But then it fully embraced neoliberalism in the 2000s. And because of this, and because they were basically the only dominant party that survived the tumultuous years of the 20 years of the transition intact, so to say, and were already in power in 94, people associated them with the power elite. Fidesz was elected to power only in 98. So they are also an ancient party in a sense that they originate from 89, but they were not in power until 98. So a large segment of the electorate thought that the early years and the mistakes that led to deindustrialization, rapid privatization, liberalization of the economy, the development of jobs, the collapse of agriculture, the rapid growth in inequalities, in fact, the mortality crisis in the early and mid-90s. You know, Fidesz was not in power, was in opposition. So a lot of people believe that they are sort of a new force and they would be able to lead the country towards a new direction, to change the economy and correct the mistakes of the post-socialist change. And this is what I found most striking in the in these 82 interviews, how economic disillusionment was gradually turned into a kind of nationalism among a large part of the interviewees. And I think the reason for this is again, because there was no progressive or left-wing language to express their anger. I mean, you would think that, that inequality and this kind of economic dislocation is really a breeding ground for left-wing politics, but it was not, because it, as I've said, it was the left who presided over the most avant-garde neoliberal policies. So there was also no left-wing symbolic culture. There was no left-wing subculture, so to speak. And there was no language other than nationalism for people to say, you know, we are disillusioned and we are unhappy and we want change. And the way they would say it is, we Hungarians. They wouldn't say we workers or we the working class or any kind of political identity that would be more, you know, useful for or that, that would lend itself for left-wing politics. And then this was acted upon by Fidesz and then strengthened also once Viktor Orbán got into power in 2010. So this kind of working class neo-nationalism is crucial to understand the stability and the legitimacy of Orbán's regime. It's a kind of on-the-ground cultural change which to a certain degree legitimizes economic nationalism also, but a cultural change that is very much related to economic disillusionment. And there's some change taking place among the opposition, but until recently, you know, the dominant language and the identity of the opposition, and in fact, the biggest parties of the opposition until now, is more kind of a technocratic, liberal language, a kind of centrist language that is, I think, completely detached from the experience of these working class electorates who were some years before the most important voter bloc behind the Socialist Party, and now they are completely wiped out from these medium-sized industrial towns. So it's Fidesz, and then the second party in these towns is Jobbik, which is, you know, the party that used to be radical right. It's now sort of a center right, and then come like around 10% or sometimes even less the various left-wing parties that exist. So it's the left has basically been completely wiped out from these towns, and it's only the biggest cities and the biggest towns. And until recently, now because of the corona crisis, it's changing again. But until recently, Fidesz could maintain its support among the victims of his upward redistributive economic policies, and the left, interestingly, could maintain its dominance among managers, most of them working for transnational corporations, and you know, educated workers working for transnational corporations and managers. This was the only strata, sort of upper middle class, big city voters, where the left was basically dominant.
If the opposition is going to have a chance of defeating him in 2022. Will it have to do what you sort of suggested there, which is to for the left and liberal parties to focus on the big cities, and for Jobbik to be the main challenger in these sort of Rust Belt areas? Is that a workable coalition?
Well, because Jobbik is changing and because parties are learning the need to cooperate, and because voters are now also sort of warming to this grand opposition coalition between, you know, a post-fascist radical right party, liberals, and the former socialist left, this could work. And it's a very strange coalition, but that's the political situation in the country. And because one of the institutional tools used by Orbán was to rewrite the electoral law, making Hungary much more similar to a first past the post system than to a proportional representation system. So the Hungarian electoral system is not completely like the system in the UK, but is more like in the UK now than it was 10 years ago, and much less like in Germany, which is more kind of a proportional system. And in this case, it's two dominant blocks, you know, the government and the opposition. And now the opposition has made an agreement to form an electoral coalition for the 22 elections, the upcoming national elections. And this is the first important step. And yes, Jobbik could play an important role in attracting this economically angry electorate too, but you know, me personally, I'm a bit worried for the long-term perspectives. A, for the stability of such coalition. B, that, you know, the left, if the left gets used to a situation where it only talks to big city upper middle class people, and completely abandons people like, you know, traditional working class people in smaller towns, then there won't be a left-wing majority in the country in the next two decades. And I think that's a huge problem, because Jobbik could then at that any time say, you know, well, I'm a right-wing party and I'd rather go with Fidesz again. And you know, Fidesz has implemented all the policies of Jobbik. And the only reason that Jobbik is now so staunchly opposed to Fidesz is because Fidesz attempted to basically politically kill Jobbik and alienated Jobbik big time, because they saw Jobbik as a major challenger party. And instead of forging an alliance with a party that is very close to them, they alienated them, and now Jobbik is firmly embedded in the oppositional culture. And Jobbik voters themselves now accept something that they would not have accepted even 5 years ago, which is cooperation with the left and liberal parties.
And what do you think Orbán and Fidesz will do if they think they may lose in 2022? I mean, they have quite a lot to lose. Do you think there'll be another change in the electoral law or further changes to the institutions to make it more difficult for the opposition to win?
Certainly. So there are already signs of this happening. So they changed the electoral law a few weeks ago at the end of last year, making it more difficult for the opposition to cooperate. And there are other things that they are doing, which is basically doing the same thing, just getting more and more extreme and further away from democracy. Like one of the most important things that they did recently was significantly reduce the financial autonomy of local governments. And, you know, local governments have been the last, some local governments, not the majority, but some local governments, like, for example, Budapest, which is the most important, biggest city in the country, have been pockets of resistance. So that's where basically the opposition managed to survive in some of the cities, some of the local towns. And Orbán is reducing their financial autonomy, basically nationalizing previously locally provided services and locally owned institutions, and also nationalizing taxes that were previously local taxes, now are national taxes. So it's everything financially depends now on the government. And you know, there's not even a pretense for democracy anymore. Orbán has announced that they are willing to compensate smaller local governments. Smaller in Hungary means overwhelmingly Fidesz. And the biggest ones, like big cities, they would have to negotiate on a case-by-case basis, so there won't be an automatic mechanism to compensate for the loss of tax revenues, which means the big cities run by Fidesz mayors have already received financial subsidies, whereas big cities run by the left are just left to starve and fend for themselves, which means basically Orbán trying to, alienate local voters and try to reduce the financial room of the opposition to maneuver. So this is just one of the things that has been happening recently. But I'm quite sure that they will be able to come up with other creative tools and measures to make the life of the opposition harder, both in terms of the institutional structure, but also I think there will be another big campaign, like the campaign against migration was a few years ago, which helped Orbán to win the 2018 elections with two-thirds majority. I think they will try to come up with something similar. Now, the big problem for the government is the pandemic. And they were completely unprepared for the pandemic. They didn't do as badly as, let's say, Trump, but they aren't doing particularly well. So populists in power are not particularly well in managing things, which would need, you know, some degree of respect for technocratic expertise. And that's not really the area of Orbán-type national populists. So they like fighting migrants, but they don't like actually solving problems. And the country is facing serious social and economic tensions now because of the pandemic. And the popularity of Fidesz has been declining in the last 6 months. And in fact, they are now at the level where they were in 2012, which was basically the last time when the opposition had a chance to win at the national election. So the first term, 2010-2013 term, when in 12 and 13, Fidesz was relatively unpopular again because mostly of the unpopular upward redistributive economic policies, the same policies that they are pursuing under the corona pandemic, making just the poor poorer and the rich richer. That's the thing that they do, and it's amazing how they could get away with this, basically socialism for the rich and capitalism for the poor politics.
Well, I mean, it is similar to the Trump playbook. You know, if you actually look at policy delivery in the United States over the last 4 years domestically, it was a classic Republican platform, but with this working class rhetoric coming from the president. So
exactly,
similar approach.
I think if I may just add one more thing is I think Orbán is just one representative of this global tendency. Trump was another one of a national populist hybridization of neoliberalism. So you have this very, you know, in American terms, Republican policies, but because they don't work in the same way as they used to work, let's say in the 90s, you need some kind of national populist embedding of the same neoliberal policies that favor the economic elites. And I think this is what we see under Orbán in Hungary. This is what we saw under Trump. But I think the UK resembles the same constellation to a certain degree. So you can see this populist hybridization of neoliberalism in many countries around the world.
And you say in the book, you say the importance of the EU as an anchor actually waned once Hungary was in. You know, once they were inside and embedded, it became less important to domestic politics. Is that still the case? And do you think that, let's say, as you said earlier, let's say that Fidesz does carry out more illiberalism over the next year and a half to try and prevent the opposition from winning, and the EU actually does respond in some kind of force, would that have an impact on these kind of working class voters who might worry about the loss of fiscal transfers or that sort of thing? Or is the EU seen as a paper tiger?
Theoretically, the EU could have power over Orbán. As you know, just go back a few years in time in Greece, when the Greek people voted against austerity under the Syriza government, the EU and the Troika made sure that basically the Syriza government has to bow to the powers that be and either change course or change government. That was the only option for Greece. And you know, and it was the financial power of EU elites, especially the European Central Bank, used to basically pressurize Greece. And it was very powerful and very effective. Not that I liked it, but you know, if the elites want to achieve something, they have the tools. The only question is whether they prioritize democracy and democratic norms to the same degree as they prioritize financial interest and austerity. And sadly, it appears to me that, you know, EU is much more about financial integration and economic interest than about political integration and democratic interest and democratic values. That's a very sad story that we had to learn under, you know, during the past few years concerning Hungary, where it's mostly only rhetorics. And this is changing to a certain degree recently with the tying of EU funds to rule of law conditionality. But then again, Orbán managed to make very important concessions. So most of the democratic backsliding dimensions are unrelated to EU funds. So the media issue, parties, local governments, all the things that make Hungary a non-democratic country are not part of this rule of law deal. The rule of law mechanism only concerns the way EU funds themselves are spent. So basically, whether there's corruption involved in the way funds are spent or not, that's basically the rule of law mechanism. And even this watered down mechanism has been postponed after 2022, so which is basically the fourth election that Viktor Orbán will be able to face without any significant sanctions from the EU. And, you know, should he win again, and even despite of the current crisis, he still has, a better chance of winning than the opposition has. Should he win again, then, you know, it's already, he's been already in power for quite a long time. Two decades, and that's already, you know, a lot of things can happen under that much time. And he again will have 4 years to continue restructuring the fundamental institutional landscape of the country. So, you know, I don't want to sound too pessimistic, but this is my rather negative reading of the role that EU elites played. But it's not really EU elites, it's themselves, because the parliament or the commission is a different player, and it's really the European People's Party and especially the German conservatives that are able to block decisions in the European Council and also partly in the European Parliament. But it's mostly the worst things are happening in the European Council and there the European People's Party and their way of harboring Orbán. That's just the, you know, that's just very sad and disillusioning story about basically economic elites, German investors winning under Orbán. They don't really care about democracy. They don't really care about authoritarianism. As long as there is financial stability, austerity, Europe's lowest taxation, they don't really bother what politically happens in the country.
Yeah. Okay, well, before we finish, I've developed a short-lived tradition to ask my guests to choose a book they recommend, any book they like. What did you choose, Gabor?
So my choice is a book about the political economy of health. As I mentioned previously, I think this is a very powerful way to capture the lived experience of economic change. And this is a book by Anne Case and Angus Deaton, Deaton being a Nobel laureate economist and his wife, Anne Case. They wrote a book titled Deaths of Despair and the Future of Capitalism. And it's about the rising mortality rates of working class Americans and the declining life expectancy of working class Americans over the past 20 years. So if you want to pick one measure which shows that there is something fundamentally wrong with the way the economy is structured in the US, is I think just look at this. Like normally life expectancy should increase, but it's decreasing for working class Americans, which is I think a very tragic story showing that this there is something fundamentally wrong, basically an existential crisis of this kind of liberal capitalist model. And at one point, they also mention the post-socialist mortality crisis that hit Eastern Europe, although don't really get into the details. But I think the parallels are obvious, and not just in terms of increased death rates in the 90s in Hungary and increased death rates over the past two decades in the US, but also in terms of its political implications. You know, Trump was much more popular in areas with elevated death rates. And we don't have the same calculations for Hungary in terms of mortality and Fidesz popularity in 2010. But we know that it's the same deindustrialized areas where working class people switched their allegiance from the Socialist Party to Fidesz that were all the same towns that experienced the biggest increase in mortality in the 90s. And this also, you know, suggests what the kind of policies could be to both to improve the lives of people, like fundamental economic changes, reducing inequality, increasing economic security, which would not only allow, improved quality of life and improved life expectancy, but this is, I think, crucial also to fight populism. So the health of people and the health of democracy are, I think, intertwined. And that's one of the biggest lessons of this book and also Hungary's story.
Thank you. Good choice. Today, I've been talking to Gabor Schering about his Retreat of Liberal Democracy, published by Palgrave Macmillan. Gabor, thank you again for joining the podcast.
Thank you very much.